Good evening and welcome to Behind the News for August 1st, 2002. This is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the world's economics and politics. And we've got two segments scheduled, two guests, rather, scheduled for this evening. First, we'll speak with Ree Teixeira, who is a public opinion expert at the Century Foundation, on the public opinion impact of the corporate scandals and such. There is a wave of anti-corporate sentiment out there, a very cheering wave of anti-corporate sentiment, and we'll get Ree Teixeira to give us the numbers on that. And then at the bottom of the hour, we'll speak with Michael Hart, who is the co-author of the book Empire, with Antonio Negri, about the reception of that book, the great splash it caused, and any thoughts he's had by its reception or what intervening events into its publication. So that'll be about 5:30. And before I get to Ree Teixeira, I want to say a few things myself. I said a few weeks ago that this program needed a new name, that the Behind the News strip at 5 p.m. weekdays was no more, and that a new moniker would be appropriate to a more freestanding program. Well, on reflection, I think I'll keep the name. Behind the News is a good one, and it's nice. It's a nice living memorial to the man who created the program, the late and still severely missed Samori Marksman. And as you heard, I'm keeping the theme, too, so a blow for continuity and tradition. As an homage to one of the funniest guys on TV, Bill O'Reilly of Fox News, I started a feature called The Most Ridiculous Item of the Week, inspired by O'Reilly's Most Ridiculous Item of the Day. Competition is tough, but I think this week's winner is Wade Horn, the Bush administration's welfare reform czar. A story in the New York Times earlier this week reported that while welfare reform, which is the polite term for kicking people off the rolls and forcing them into the hostile waters of the low-wage labor market, while welfare reform was intended to encourage marriage, and in fact the preamble to the bill began with a declaration that marriage is the foundation of a healthy society, in fact the pressures of coping with employment and child care have driven many mothers to the desperate solution of handing off their kids to foster care. Commenting on this unhappy and presumably unexpected outcome, Horn told the Times that the new welfare demands might expose an unfit parent whose children are better off in foster care. We can be sure that Horn himself never tried to flip burgers and take care of kids at the same time. But the administration is not to be deterred from its goal of re-engineering American family structures. Writing on the editorial page of today's Wall Street Journal, which, as Michael Thomas once said, is what the paper has in lieu of a comics page, the dreadful duo of Jack Kemp and William Bennett tout an intensification of welfare reform, which they remind us is about much more than economics. Quote, the moral and spiritual condition of the recipients must be considered, end quote. No word, though, about the moral and spiritual condition of our CEOs. Kemp and Bennett continue. Therefore, we salute one of the most significant, if controversial, elements in the president's proposal. My administration, the president said, will give unprecedented support to strengthening marriage. This was a goal of the original Welfare Reform Act, Kemp and Bennett add. Unfortunately, few states work towards it. But we can think of no more effective way of reducing the number of poor people, especially poor children, than reducing the number of single-parent families. No, Jack and Bill, it's not the lack of marriage that makes people poor. It's low wages, no benefits, and crummy schools. But there's nothing like a good sermon to distract from the fundamentals. A close runner-up for the ridiculous item of the week were comments by our bumbling Treasury Secretary, Paul O'Neill. O'Neill, who just the other week was wondering why people cared what he had to say or think about imploding financial markets, hey, he's only the second or third most important economic official in the world, O'Neill had the following answer to a question about whether the U.S. would support some rescue efforts for the economic crises in Argentina and Brazil. Said O'Neill, critically, they need to put in place policies that would assure that as assistance money comes, it does some good and it doesn't just go out of the country to Swiss bank accounts. The remarks provoked outrage in the countries themselves and deepened broad foreign perceptions that the U.S. is being run by a gang of callous, ignorant, and bellicose provincials. You'd hardly know it from the newspapers, but the economic troubles in Latin America are deepening. The situation in Argentina is fairly well known. It's not an exaggeration to say that that country is in the midst of a severe economic and political crisis. But they're not alone. Brazil's currency is crashing. At one point yesterday, the market in the Brazilian real completely froze up. Anxieties about Brazil's crisis are causing ripple effects in Colombia, Peru, and Ecuador as investors pull capital out of those countries. And Uruguay, where a lot of Argentines stash their money, is now in the midst of a banking crisis as desperate Argentines are taking their money home. Latin America has been in and out of economic crises for the past 20 years, but it looks to be seriously in the in phase right now. Neoliberalism, which promised eventual prosperity after a round of pain, has succeeded in delivering only pain and no prosperity. One reason for the deepening crises south of the Rio Grande is the weakness of the U.S. economy. When our economy weakens, we take less in exports from Latin America, and the U.S. economy is not looking so healthy these days. Every July, the government revises its estimate of GDP and related measures for the previous 3 years. The first estimates are usually based on incomplete sources, and as more definitive numbers roll in, the estimates are refined. The latest batch of revisions is quite significant. The bottom line is the economy grew more slowly between 1999 and the first quarter of this year than was originally thought. The boom was less boomy, and the bust over the last year was much deeper than we realized. A bit over 1% was taken off estimates of consumption levels, but 3% was taken off investment, 5% off business purchases of equipment and software, 4% off wage and salary income, and 9% off corporate profits. The revision of the profits numbers was quite interesting. Early figures are based on the numbers that the corporations released to the public, the very numbers that are now in great disrepute. The government revises the profits numbers when they get a look at corporate tax returns, which happens with a delay of a couple of years. They had complete tax figures for 1999 and preliminary ones for 2000. And those numbers led to sharp markdowns in estimates of corporate profits. And since profits are the motor of the system is looking a bit sickly. And finally, the heavily advertised productivity miracle of the last several years also looks considerably less miraculous on second glance. With outputs and incomes now marked down, the productivity stats are likely to be marked down as well. So it's not just the stock market that suffered a downdraft, the real economy has as well. Now, as anyone who's listened regularly to this show or anyone who's read any of my writing knows, I'm not given to alarmism. I've long thought that the tendency of many people on the political left to see every economic twitch as the harbinger of crisis is overdone, embarrassing, and not particularly helpful. But I fear we're at the edge of stepping into a vicious cycle, a circle. Remember, the U.S. economy is heavily indebted. Business and household debt is at record levels, and as a nation, we're deeply in hock to the rest of the world. Any sustained economic weakness will make these debts harder and harder to service. The vicious cycle might run something like this. People and businesses have a harder time paying debts. They default. Their creditors take a hit, call in loans from the solvent, and refuse to extend new loans to those who need them. Economic activity slows as a result of these financial disturbances, which then feed back in the form of more debt and financial troubles. More debt troubles lead to more loans being called in and fewer new loans being made. An economy addicted to debt loses fresh supplies and completely implodes. This has been happening in the southern part of our hemisphere, but the imperial center, the U.S., has been exempt so far. If the U.S. economy doesn't pick up soon, though, then that exemption may well be lifted. Of course, this isn't inevitable, but the risks are quite high. And the latest batch of economic stats isn't very encouraging. Households report that their finances are deteriorating, workers report that jobs are getting harder to find, and the recovery in the manufacturing sector seems to be unraveling. And we're being governed by a gang of thieving idiots. I expect that the July employment figures, to be released tomorrow morning at 8:30, won't make for very cheery reading. I hope I'm wrong. Back after this advertisement for commodity fetishism from the great Foxy Brown.
Like bad parties at crazy proper. Got a money fetish. Wanna see me where your bet is? Playboy, y'all got to give me 5 letters like Prada, Jacob, Fendi, Boots, C, Dior, Chloe, Suits, Range, Rover, Gucci, Shoes, First Class, Black Class, Paras.
That was Foxy Brown from Broken Silence, her latest album, intoning the magical brand names that move us all to commodity lust. And we'll be joined in just a moment by Rita Shera, who is a fellow of the Century Fund based in Washington and who puts out a weekly review of public opinion, Public Opinion Watch, which you can find on the Century Fund's website at tcf.org. Century Foundation, rather, formerly known as the 20th Century Fund. And it seems that the corporate scandals are really having quite an effect on public opinion, maybe more so than a lot of people realize. And Rita Shera, who is a student of these matters, will now review the evidence for us. Welcome to WBAI, Rui.
Howdy.
In your latest, you report that anti-corporate sentiments now seem to be reaching levels not seen since the 1970s. How serious is this?
Well, I think it's pretty serious, particularly if you're a Republican and you're worried about what's going to happen to your party in the November elections and beyond. One of the things that's underpinned the Republican Party for a number of years has been a sense that even though that they are the party of business and big business, and that's actually pretty good because we like business. We like the market. We like the way things work when business is kind of more or less allowed to do what it needs to do with a minimum of government regulation. There was a certain level of trust in that whole system to work its way out for the benefit of most. That faith has been lost.
Now, how much did the bull market contribute to that
reputation? Oh, very much so. I think it was reached a crescendo in some ways, even though anti-government sentiment per se, anti-regulation sentiment, was probably highest during the 80s. The glorification of the results of the market and of the ability of business to lay oh so many golden eggs, I think, was highest in the 90s.
And it wasn't all that long ago that, you know, what, 5-6 years ago, Newt Gingrich was riding high, and public sentiment was apparently behind him. How serious was that support for the sort of contract in America agenda in the first place?
Well, it was fairly serious, but it was also fairly overblown. In other words, there was definitely a there, but Gingrich and his acolytes definitely overestimated how much of a mandate they had from the public, because as soon as they get into office and they tried to implement the more draconian parts of the contract with America, try to get rid of just regulations across the board, eliminate governmental departments, you know, cut popular spending programs by, you know, large amounts, this just wasn't very popular. I mean, the fact of the matter is, though, that the public was in an anti-government mood when they elected Gingrich and his colleagues, they didn't think that meant that, therefore, it was desirable to get rid of all government protections and get rid of as much as possible of government spending programs. They weren't libertarians in the sense that Gingrich and many of his followers were.
Well, what does it really mean when people answer some of these poll questions? Are you for or against government? Some of them are so broad. Do they have any meaning, or are they just kind of measures of sentiment?
Well, I think they do have some meaning, but they also are, of course, measures of sort of current sentiment, and you always have to view answers to any of these questions through the prism of what the current public mood is. And also, it's good to look carefully at the actual wording of the question to see how it's going to pick up or not pick up that changing public mood. Yeah, these things can be volatile, so you've always got to be careful about how you interpret them.
And before we go any further, I bet there are a lot of people out there who are very skeptical about the whole enterprise of polling, either think they're cooked or manipulated or just part of a machinery of propaganda and deception. How seriously should people take these things?
Well, I guess I'm biased a little bit, but I think people should take them pretty seriously. A carefully done poll with carefully worded questions really does tell us a lot of things about what the public is thinking that you're not going to get any other way. And it is, in a way, amazing that you can ask 1,000 people or 1,200 people and you're, with some reasonable statistical certainty, going to get pretty close to what people really think. Now, you know, always desirable to take it a few levels deeper and look carefully at the wording of the questions, look carefully at the trends on those questions over time. But I still think that if you really want to get a sense of what the public actually thinks is going on in the country and about public policy and about politicians, there's really no substitute, no better way. I mean, if you don't rely on that, you wind up relying on what your friends told you or some bogus focus group that some consultant reports on. I mean, this way you get some hard numbers you can take a look at.
And let's look at some of these numbers on the corporate scandals issue. First of all, what about public confidence in large corporations? What's been happening to that?
Well, public confidence in large corporations has basically kind of collapsed, as I covered in, I think, my most recent column in Public Opinion Watch. It's now pretty much at the lowest level it's been since we started measuring it, and that's pretty bad. I guess the last reading I have reported on was 12% have a great deal or quite a lot of confidence in corporations, and that is the lowest since I started asking the question in 75. So, you know, that's pretty bad.
And 75, of course, was right after Watergate, oil crisis, and mass alienation and distress, right?
So that's right.
We're
that's
comparing
right.
it to quite a remarkable period, not just some mythical moment in the distant past.
I don't think so. I think this is going to stay with us for a while.
Yeah, that's. I want to get to that question in a moment. But let's see what else. The questions on regulation were quite something. What are the evaluations of the risks of regulation right now?
Well, as we were just talking about Newt Gingrich, when he came into power there in January of '95, they asked people basically, "Did you think most regulations were unnecessary and harm the economy, or did you think they were necessary to protect consumers, the environment, and so on?" And by 47% to 40%, people said, "Well, I think most regulations really aren't necessary now that I think about it." And they just asked the same question again a week ago, and now by 59% to 36%, people think those regulations are actually necessary. So that's quite a shift. And similar questions have been asked by other polling outfits, and they pretty much all catch that same shift. Toward suddenly seeing that regulation ain't such a bad thing after all.
And as you point out, people think that the greatest risk now is that the regulations won't go far enough, not that they won't go too far, that they'll go too far.
That's right. I mean, that's been picked up in a number of polls, and it makes some things we've seen recently kind of interesting. I know the Democratic Leadership Council had their gathering there in New York, and a number of them were apparently, including Joe Lieberman and some others, saying, well, the thing we have to be really careful about here is not seeming to be too anti-business and not kill the goose that lays the golden eggs and all this kind of stuff. And, well, that may be what they think, but that doesn't appear to be what the public thinks. Usually these people are very politically attuned, so it's interesting to see them so at variance with where the public appears to be at the moment.
And evaluations of, as you right, business and companies in general, at the end of the Clinton years, 45% of people said that companies care mostly about the quality of service, charge fair prices, and treat their customers well. How do people feel right now?
Well, yeah, that's another fascinating little data point. They asked the same question again just recently, and they found that overwhelmingly, you know, over 70% bought the characterization of companies that they're basically after profits. They're cutting corners, they're, you know, inflating costs, they're doing all these bad things. So, that's quite a turnaround again in a relatively short period of time to seeing, you know, sort of the dark side of corporate America as sort of what's in people's top of mind.
And more broadly, I mean, Bush's approval ratings right after September 11th were, you know, at record high levels for any president. And I think the Gallup number just broke below 70 for the first time since then. What about Bush's approval in office right now? Is he still invincible?
Oh, definitely not. I mean, I've been arguing for quite a while that, you know, Bush's approval ratings and other feelings about him would return to earth, and in fact, have been returning to earth at the rate, if you just look at the approval rating, of roughly 2 points a month, 2 percentage points a month. But what's happened recently is they're now dropping much faster, like about double the pace, about 4 or 5 points a month. So who knows where I'll be in a few months, but I think the bloom is off the rose for sure. And you look at, you know, look beyond overall approval ratings, the approval rating on something like the economy or how has he been handling the corporate scandals, and they're essentially quite negative.
Is that what's driving it, the weak economy and the scandals?
I beg your pardon?
Is that what's driving his numbers downward? Or?
Well, it's a weak economy. It's the scandals. It's the sense that he doesn't know what the heck he's doing, the sense that he might be on the wrong side. Because that's another thing the polls have picked up, is that people went from giving him a real break on this issue of whose side are you on, dealing with the corporate scandals, other problems. Do you think Bush is more on the side of regular folks, basically, or on the side of the large corporations? And just a few weeks ago, people were saying they thought he was basically on the side of, you know, the average Joe and Jane. But that's completely turned around, and now people feel by a fairly healthy margin that he's on the side of the corporations. Of course, they feel the Republicans in Congress are even worse. But definitely Bush's doesn't receive a buy anymore in that kind of a question. So I think the whole, all of these economic and scandal-related factors just come together to undermine that sense, you know, Bush is different from other Republicans. He's, you know, still my kind of guy, even though, you know, I think Trent Lott's an idiot, you know, so.
Speaking with Rita Shera, who is a public opinion scholar at the Century Foundation based in D.C. What about this is a classic pollster question. Do you think the country is going in the right direction or is it on the wrong track? And pollsters have been asking this question for quite a long period of time. First of all, what really does the question mean? What does it measure? And are we on the right track right now?
Well, it measures, it seems to be one of the better questions to measure sort of the mood of the public about how they feel things are doing out there in general, and very tied to that, how they feel about the stewardship of the country by whoever is viewed as having the most power. In this case, it would be the Republicans. So typically for the party that's more or less the incumbent, for wrong track to be higher than right direction is bad. And when wrong track breaks under 40%, it's really bad. And that's basically what's happened in the last period of time, is you've gone from a situation where most people were saying the country was going in the right direction to now we have a situation where most people say it's on the wrong track, and a number of polls now have wrong track under right direction under 40%. I think the NPR poll that just came out today had it at 36%, with 56% saying wrong track. So that's a difference of minus 20. And, you know, a couple of months ago, several months ago, it was 53-35. That we're going in the right direction for plus 18. So that's a swing of 38 points in a few months. That really is the kind of stuff that scares the pants off the Republicans, because they know that's powerful stuff, and they're trying to scramble right now to see if they can kind of reposition themselves to get some credit for clamping down on the corporate scandals, and they're praying the economy will turn around, and, you know, maybe they're just doing a lot of praying.
Well, that's their politics, right? Now, these are kinds of numbers we saw, in the early 90s, back during the days of the angry voter and the alienated white guy, and also in the distress of the 70s, too, right? So these are pretty troubled numbers, right?
Yeah, they are, and it's interesting. When this stuff first started happening, I guess the Enron was sort of the wedge into it, and then that seemed to take a long time to bubble, and then these other sort of wave after wave of these additional scandals hit. But for a long time, it was sort of people looked at the data, including myself, were wondering, well, how much would this really amount to? Because it didn't seem to be taking off. It didn't seem to be shattering public confidence the way you thought maybe it should. But that's really changed in the last month. Now we see all the signs of returning to a period where people's faith in institutions really is shaken. People's faith in the incumbent administration is shaken. People sense things are very much going in the wrong, off on the wrong track, as we were just discussing, and just wondering, you know, where the hell we're going. So I do think that finally, you know, who knows which straw was that broke this camel's back, but somewhere along the line we got there, and now we're in a very different political situation than we were, say, 6 weeks ago.
I have to admit, I was skeptical at first myself, but I was wrong.
Yeah, me too.
You mentioned earlier the DLC meeting in town a couple of days ago, and they're all saying that the reason that Gore lost the election was because he ran too far to the left, and Lieberman mm-hmm. says we mustn't look anti-business, we must be the party of business. Lieberman himself, of course, was quite friendly to the accounting industry, among other things, so he's got some explaining to do. But what of this general DLC argument that the reason that Gore lost was he was too left, and that they need to hew to the DLC line more tightly than ever?
Well, I don't think it really holds water. I mean, I've looked at those data pretty closely, and actually I have a new book coming out with John Judas called The Emerging Democratic Majority, where, among other things, we take, you know, visit that question a little bit when we think about democratic strategy as it's evolved in the 90s and into the 00s, and deal with that kind of critique that Gore was too left, too populist. And I just don't think the data support it. If you look at where Gore started really doing well, it was right after his convention speech, which is, you know, the sort of populist people versus the powerful thing. And where he kind of lost his way was around the time of the debates, you know, sort of this sense that the guy can't be trusted. He's you know, his affect is too weird. Bush did a pretty good job of sort of putting some of the issues in play that Gore had actually put in play, too, and saying essentially Me Too. So a number of things happened, but it would be hard to say based on that, and certainly hard to say based on the data we looked at after the election, which showed that it wasn't really things like being against big corporations or whatever that seemed to make people less interested in voting for Gore. It was things about he can't be trusted, the Clinton scandals, the variety of seemingly cultural things more than anything else that seemed to turn a lot of voters away from Gore. And certainly if you're going to put your finger on one factor, I think that those would be better factors than the so-called populist thing, which really was pretty popular. And it was, what was he talking about? He was saying big insurance companies, big accounting firms, if you thought to mention it, big oil companies, whatever. There are some corporate actors who don't quite play by the rules, and they should. And, the Democratic Party should essentially be their tribune against people who abuse the system. Well, that doesn't sound so crazy now, I don't think. And I don't think it actually sounded that crazy to people at the time either. And there's very little evidence, I think, that that's how it actually played in the public. So, it's a little strange to see this whole thing, not only to have this debate rehashed now, not only to have, well, let me put it this way, the debate happened after the 2000 election, so it's strange to be talking about it now as they're going into 2002, and it's especially strange to be talking about it now when you're making a point that seems so totally at variance with where politics is at today. Where is the evidence that the Democrats are now being hurt by being too populist? There is none.
Are they being too populist? Who's being populist?
The problem is that, if anything, they're not being populist enough, or they're not being tough enough. As we were just discussing, the public is more worried about regulators not going far enough than they're going to go too far. People are wondering, if this thing's really going to be gotten under control. People like Lieberman, who seek to kind of blunt the Democratic attack on these issues and try to protect the accounting industry and so on, don't seem to me like they're doing the Democrats any favor in terms of how they're playing with the public.
Of course, a lot of Democrats have a problem in that they got the contributions from Enron and WorldCom, too, and they would have some explaining to do about their contributors list.
Yeah, that's right. No, that does present a structural problem to dealing with this in the way maybe it would be optimal from both a policy and political standpoint. But I think the contention that, it's sound politics to be as pro-business as possible, even in this environment, I think is just not sustainable. There may be other reasons for doing it, but I don't think it's because, we just want to, be at one with the public who are all sitting there tearing out their hair because they're worried the Democrats are going to be too anti-business. I just don't see it.
Just a little over 3 months from the congressional election, so it's not really too early to start talking about those. What does it look like? What's that shaping up like? And you also write about how bear market victims may be the swing voters in the election.
There's some pretty good evidence that's coming out that some of these kind of voters are going to be among the most volatile and are in the sort of the foulest mood about the way things have gone. And it does look like we're moving into a situation where, several months ago, if you looked at the polls and so on and just assessed the general political situation, you would have questioned whether the Democrats could take back the House. And it looked like the Republicans really might sustain very little damage at all in this election. Now things look a lot different. We got the right direction, wrong track numbers. We got the Democrats swinging into a lead in a generic congressional question. We've got a lot of indicators of volatility out there among the electorate. A lot of people saying they're not sure they should vote to reelect their congressman. That's always an important indicator when the so-called reelect number for people's own congressman gets into the low 40s. So there's a sense that there's probably a lot of people out there, more people than we would have thought a month or two ago, who are looking for a change, who are going to be thinking hard about whether they want to reelect the incumbent, or going to be looking at challengers. And given the mood of the country, all of that favors the Democrats.
Now, the Republicans are trying to make the argument that the bubble blew up, or expanded, rather. Not, it blew up more recently than that, but it expanded during the Clinton years. Mm-hmm. The Democrats are at least as responsible for it as the Republicans. Is that charge sticking in the public mind?
Well, I don't think so, though. That's a hard thing to measure. Certainly, there is a sense among people, if you ask certain questions, that the Democrats are also in hock to big business. The big business has too much influence over the Democrats, though people think it's even worse for the Republicans. And just logically, some of this stuff did happen on their watch. They know about the contributors, rich contributors, big corporations, and so on. They contribute to both parties. So there's a sense in which the Democrats also suffer from this jaundiced view on the part of the public. But I also think that if you look at the data, it's clear that the public blames the Republicans more and associates the Republicans more closely with business and business abuses than they do with the Democrats. It's not that the Democrats have a clear field, but they have a better they're viewed in a better light than the Republicans.
Yeah, my impression is that the people that take the blame are the ones who are in office at the moment bad things happen.
And that's right.
They might to blame their predecessors. It doesn't.
That's right. It's always hard to say, you know, there's a recession now, but it was really caused by what the previous administration did. People tend to look at the guy up there and say, that's the one I want to get rid of.
All right. Well, thank you for joining us. Rita Shera, who is a public opinion expert at the Century Foundation. And you can find his Public Opinion Watch on their website at tcf.org, and also is a co-author with John Judas of a forthcoming book on the emerging Democratic majority. Back in about 30 seconds to speak with Michael Hart. And that was Patti Smith with a slogan from around 1976, "We created it, let's take it over," which could as well be the slogan for Empire. But before I should say this is WBAN at 9.5 FM in New York and on the web at WBAI.org. My name is Doug Hamlin. The show is Behind the News. And now we're joined by a co-author of Empire, Michael Hart, co-written with Antonio Negri, published a couple of years ago now by Harvard University Press, and created quite a splash. Did you have any idea that this would happen, that your picture would take up a quarter of a New York Times page, Michael Hart?
And no, that never occurred to me.
What do you attribute this reception to?
I don't know. Do you have an idea?
Well, you must have been talking to a lot of people over the last couple of years, and they can tell you what they got from it and why it mattered so much to them.
Well, one thing it seems is that the book provided a kind of framework for at least discussing issues about globalization, about discussing globalization from a left perspective that wasn't simply a defeatist or even defensive view about globalization. But really, like you suggest with Patti Smith, I'm flattered, that globalization has been an object of the left, that it had been a desire of the left, and that in some ways the processes that go under this large umbrella of globalization can be an enormous opportunity for the left. I mean, in part I mean that it's always been a project that the left think of the First International, think of slogans like
"Workers of the World Unite."
Exactly,
the workers have no country. Right?
Exactly, or the whole world is our country.
But you know, in recent years, there's been sort of an anti-globalization left that talks about getting back to the nation state, or even localities or regions, mm-hmm. and bioregions or whatever. You're not a fan of that kind of retreat?
Well, I think that there are, for instance, at each of the various protests, say from Seattle to Genoa. And then also at Porto Alegre, at the World Social Forum, it seems to me that there is one could divide the group into two. The one part of the group is properly speaking anti-globalization, which would either be think of the nation state as the proper defense against global capital or other forces, or like you say, a more local in the sense of isolating perspective. But there's another half which I think is not anti-globalization, or I would even say more than half, I think, involved in these protests. The protests themselves are a globalizing force. They're not localistic in any isolationist sense, but rather thinking about place and the importance of the local in a global context in terms of connections. Think of the movements themselves. They certainly aren't separatist. What they're all about is constructing new kinds of communication, new kinds of cooperation. So I think if one should call this, which seems to me the majority of those involved, both in groups like the World Social Forum or in the various protests, I think of them really as an alternative globalization movement rather than an anti-globalization movement. And this is a way, I think, of redirecting these processes for our own good, for the good of all.
You say on right on page 43 of the book, which is one of my favorite quotes, I quote it whenever I can, we insist on asserting that the construction of empire is a step forward in order to do away with any nostalgia for the power structures that preceded it and refuse any political strategy that involves returning to that old arrangement, such as trying to resurrect the nation state or to protect against global capital. We claim that empire is better in the same way that Marx insists that capitalism is better than the forms of society and modes of production that came before it. Marx's view is grounded in a healthy and lucid disgust for the parochial and rigid hierarchies that preceded capitalist society, as well as on a recognition that the potential for liberation is increased in the new situation. Now, I certainly agree with that sentiment, but could you flesh that out a bit? What are the potentials in the new situation that could be taken advantage of?
Well, in the most general way, and since we were just talking about these globalization protest movements, certainly the potentials of cooperation themselves, of inter-regional cooperation, if you like, has enormous liberatory potential. It always has. I mean, this is the primary reason why globalization has, certainly at least from the times of the First International, been a theme of the left. Because we are stronger when we are together. I mean, it's a very simple, I guess I'm posing it in rather, it almost sounds silly when I pose it in such general terms. But I think that on that general foundation, it's true. It's the powers of cooperation not only function in a local way, that we cooperating together through our labor can do something greater than me separately and you separately. That extended to a global level is also true, that we become richer and we become stronger by joining ourselves with others. So I think that the various technologies, social forms, and institutions that promote globalization, even when they do it in the control of capitalist corporations, can be used alternatively, and that's the kind of thing that it seems to me the protest movements themselves are interested in, and that at least large parts of them, and that Tony and I are interested in too.
One of the reasons I play that little Patti Smith intro, created it, let's take it over, is that people tend to think of the global economy as something imposed from outside by an elite, either geographically removed or removed in some terms of some class privilege or something, and sort of don't notice that we're the workers who make this stuff happen, and we're all very closely tied to each other through our work. Right? Is that
right? Exactly. That's exactly right. And this is This isn't exactly an intellectual innovation on our part, but we certainly push it far. The notion that even when reading capitalist society, even when reading what capital or corporations or business brags about as their own achievements, we have to recognize how these are really the creativity of those who produce that's doing that, and therefore can be taken over by them. I think you're exactly right when you put the Patti Smith quote for this. That's exactly the notion that we're trying to capture, that even in what seems like an accomplishment of business or of capital or of the oppressors, one can see how the ones who are producing are actually responsible for it and the authors of the creative energy, and therefore have the power potentially to take it over and lead it towards alternative ends.
I'm speaking with Michael Hart, co-author with Antonio Negri of the book Empire, which certainly made a big splash over the last couple of years. You've been denounced, of course, for many things. The New Republic denounced you your co-author, more particularly, as the intellectual authors of terrorism. Some rather more traditional leftists have denounced you as sort of throwing aside the class struggle in favor of some vague, almost quasi-religious longing. How do you plead to these these attacks?
I mean, attacks are good. I think debate is good. What one of the things that Tony and I hoped when writing the book, we were very conscious of the fact that when you write some abstract book about trying to present a very general framework, it's going to be attacked, and it's often going to be attacked rightly. The way we see it is that's how these kinds of discussions move forward. One presents what we hoped we were doing was presenting a strong hypothesis or a strong thesis or a strong argument, let's say. We were making an argument, and then people respond, and I think that's how. So in a way, it's the kind of argument or the kind of book that invites criticisms. Some of them obviously are more useful than others. I actually didn't read this New Republic thing, but I was reported to me recently that some line was that our book is to political theory what pornography is to aesthetics, which seemed I thought that was kind of a nice idea, but I think the author of it thought it was the ultimate criticism. So.
Stimulates people to a physical response. That's not a bad thing.
I don't know. It matters what one thinks of as pornography. That would be the question. I don't think we should as authors obviously respond to each of the criticisms. When a book gets this much discussion, there are going to be some absurd ones. The ones I was surprised that we were blamed for September 11th. In the right-wing press, but maybe I shouldn't be that. Maybe a number of people were.
These people will say anything, really. Yeah. Well, let's talk a little bit about the intellectual background to this. I mean, Tony Negri literally comes out of, and you're closely affiliated with a kind of branch of Italian Marxism, which is opposed to a lot of traditional notions of people on the left who see, you know, people on the left often see that the working class is manipulated, oppressed. We're manipulated by advertising. We're oppressed by cops and by, you know, just the capitalist state. And autonomism is I think, a very healthy corrective to that kind of pessimism and passivity, and that, you know, just sees workers as active creators and not the passive subjects of manipulation that a lot of people treat them as. Could you talk a bit more about that?
Yeah, one of the things that interested us in writing the book, the moments of discovery that are fun in writing a book like this, is recognizing connections, especially connections among intellectual traditions. And there is an Italian tradition, as you describe, sometimes called workerism, sometimes called autonomism, that does try to read the struggles and especially the revolts of the working class as the active moments, even in the history of capital. The capital only can react to the creative moments that the working class initiates. One of the exciting moments in the book, or sort of one of our conscious moments of putting different ideas together, is attempting to read anti-colonial struggles in the same method, and seeing that much of what is today called post-colonial studies tries to, in a similar way, read the colonized as the authors of colonial history. In other words, that the innovations and the different steps, and then ultimately their own liberation struggles, were the authors of the oppressed. They're similar, in a way, readings of slave histories in the Americas. In other words, that it's not a triumph of liberal sentiment in Britain that posed the end of slavery, but the revolts of slaves themselves. In other words, that they were the authors of it, and they even created the terms of the post-slave societies. Why? One might say, well, what's the point in doing this? I mean, there's two questions, obviously. One is a certain kind of historical accuracy. It has to be reasonable that one would suggest that history of capital, history of slavery, history of colonialism can be read this way. But also, one has to, if one sees the historical movement in that way, one can recognize the power to create the future. In other words, that the workers aren't merely the victims and then the passive recipients of historical changes, that the slaves similarly aren't merely victims and passive recipients, but are potentially in the future authors of a new society. So if we recognize how they achieved that moment, how they achieved passages within the colonial regime and then the post-colonial, the liberation from colonialism itself, one can recognize how they the same subjects, even they're almost created new subjects in the process of their own liberation struggle, can then be active authors of a new world. So that element of recognizing the ability to create a new future, that seems an element that attracts us to this methodology. And like I said, I think it's not isolated to the Italian tradition, as you pointed out. It's definitely, that's one element of it, an Italian Marxist tradition. But I think a similar style of argumentation is common to post-colonial studies, much work on slavery, and other sorts of historical analyses.
Speaking with Michael Hart, co-author of Empire, the book published a couple of years ago by the Harvard University Press and in many translations around the world as well, right? Now, some of your critics would say that all sounds like fine sentiments, but you're kind of silent on the institutions or strategies that will get us from point A to point Z. Not too much about unions or political parties, even some hostility to those things maybe. Certainly no friendliness towards a good state. You're pretty anti-statist in your sentiments. So how do we achieve take several steps towards this utopia?
Well, there are two things. One is, I do have some ideas about that, but I think one should say first that in a philosophical book like ours, or in a philosophical project like ours, I think it's generally not a good idea to give a program or even blueprint. And I don't think it's right in this register to write a manifesto, even in this philosophical register, because I think that these things are worked out in practice, you know, that they are, or rather, in a different kind of thinking or theorizing that goes on in movements. Like, rather than having two philosophers say, this is what we should do, X, Y, Z, I think it should be done much more collectively in movements rather than a sort of dictation from above or from some separate realm. That said, I think there are many ways in which many things that are going on, I mean, that would be my response to the question would be to say, what things are going on that are moving in this direction? And clearly those who are involved in the protest movements starting in Seattle, or at least related to Seattle, maybe starting in Chiapas or however one wants to date these, and going to Genoa, or one might also put a different endpoint to it. That seems to be one sort of avenue of groups of struggles that seems to be very powerful. Not simply against the policies of the IMF, the World Bank, the WTO, the G8, etc., all the groups that they've clustered around, but ultimately to start constructing alternatives. That seems to be the object of these movements. In other words, I'm trying to say I think there are many movements and struggles going on that are moving in this direction, and what one has to do, and what one should do, or what I would do to respond to the question is try to interpret them. I mean, I think there are two things that excite me about the movements as they've been. One is the ability of them to, let's say, I would say in a shorthand way, to organize in networks. In other words, not to organize in a centralized way under a single leadership. And also not to remain separated in their various identities and various issues, but to act together and link together in a way that doesn't destroy their different groups. For instance, in the various ones in the U.S. of these different protests, we've had those who were directly concerned with the IMF, those who were involved against the prison industrial complex in the U.S., gay and lesbian groups, anarchist groups, church groups, those who were concerned primarily with debt of the poorest countries. They've managed to work together in a network in a way that doesn't either reduce to a single and subordinate the others, and this would seem to me a classic party structure, nor do they remain separated. They have been able to link in a network and work cooperatively that way. This seems to me not only an effective mode of organizing, but constructing what we say the elements of of an alternative, of a different aspect of social organizing, of a different mode of social organizing, this network structure of the movements. So I think that's one aspect of, let's say, movements that are working against the present institutional structures, and at the same time developing alternative modes of globalizing, let's say, alternative modes of global relationships.
So the movements themselves contain the seeds of a better society.
Right, and that's the way it has to be.
We're running low on time, so let me move a bit ahead of us. I'd like to linger on that a bit. But one of the theses of empire is that power these days is much more dispersed than it was in classical times. You can't point to a single capitalist who's exploiting you. You can't point to a single a national entity that is driving imperial power. That things are much more dispersed and kind of hard to put a finger on. Does the experience of the last year and a half under the Bush regime, with a very assertive U.S., a very unilateral, anti-multilateral imperial power, really trying to exert dictatorial powers against the rest of the world, does this cause you to rethink the thesis at all?
It. I'm a little too stubborn for that, but let me. It seems to me that there's. That those the global leaders, it seems to me, are faced with two choices today. I mean, that primarily these are there are two options for the political and business elites. One option is what the Bush administration might represent best, which would be a form of U.S. imperialism. In other words, there would be various global relationships, but they would be centered on the U.S. If one imagined it in a network form, it would be a kind of hub network where there'd be a single center and then radial links to every other point that would have to come through the central organizer. That seems to me,
which is historically the way Washington's liked it.
Certainly, that's the imperialist form. That's the way primarily the British imperialist project and the French imperialist project and the Dutch imperialist project too functioned, through a centralized network where inevitably, all of the advantages are economic, cultural, and political advantages are tilted towards that central power. So that's one choice we have, which I think you're right, that goes under the label in the news as Bush's unilateralism, is a kind of U.S. imperialism. I think that the other option that they have is what we call empire, meaning you could start thinking about it as a kind of multilateralism taken to an nth degree. In other words, it's not simply bringing in other dominant nation states, but it's also that. It's also recognizing the sharing of power among business elites, cultural elites, even NGOs, media, that this is what empire would be. It'd be a dispersed network of the powerful. It's not that everyone would be powerful, and that there would be a large expansion. Tony and I might call this something like a new deal for the global elite, like an extension of power to the global elite, not the single imperialist control in the hands of the U.S. Now, it seems to me that given these two options, the second, the choice of empire, is really their only option. I think that the first, U.S. imperialism, cannot work. It cannot work partly because it's bad for business. There are great potentials for capital in these processes of globalization that are thwarted by an imperialist construction of power. Secondly, the kind of security that they're after will not work, that it can only be sustained with this broader network of power. So I guess what I'm trying to say is that it seems to me, rather than saying that what we've tried to argue in the book is that this is an historical tendency, that empire is in the process of formation. It still seems to me that that's the case. We're trying in a way to argue on the side of historical necessity, like in other words, that they have no choice but to do this. If someone from the Bush administration were to call and ask, and I were so inclined to be such an advisor, I would advise them in such a direction. I think it's their only choice.
Well, they may find out that they can't launch a war in Iraq just solo.
So, right. Yeah, that's the kind of reasoning that I'm working on. That this notion of U.S. imperialism, which is not in fact practicable.
And we have only a couple seconds left. But you guys working on a sequel?
Yeah, we're working on a sequel about war and democracy. The incompatibility of the two, and the. What we're trying to understand or trying to propose is what democracy on a global scale could mean, which seems to us something fundamentally new.
All right, well, we'll have to wait for that one. Thank you for joining us, Michael Hart. Michael Hart, professor of literature at Duke University, co-author of the book Empire with Antonio Negri, published in the year 2000, I believe, by Harvard University Press. And that's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this closing word from Au Pairs.